Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. This is Jean Barta with the Custer's Luck Radio Show, and it is January 3rd, 2015. Happy New Year, and I am broadcasting from a very cold but clear Alexandria, Virginia. I say that it's cold because it certainly is cold compared to what it was last week, and especially over Christmas. And if I'm lucky today, I will not be coughing as much as I was previously in my other shows that I did last week and the week before. It will be three weeks, starting actually Monday or Tuesday, that I've had this cold and cough. It's slowly getting better, but it's still with me, and I was warned that would be the case. What I'm going to do today and for the next few weeks is actually read and discuss a book that I got as a gift this Christmas, which is a book by Ralph Kirschner, which is entitled The Class of 1861, Custer, Ames, and Their Classmates After West Point. It was a book that I expressly asked for as a present, which I luckily received. And the reason I had wanted it is that I did read some of the portions that were that you were able to get online via the Amazon.com website. But unfortunately, this book is not yet available via Kindle, so my friend had to provide me and spend good money from him for a hard copy. So I don't have that many hard copy books anymore, but I do take them and get them when there's no other way. I will add that listeners today can check in via the Blog Talk Radio website where my show is available, but then also listen in by calling 646-787-8231. I'm going to take a short break. Please listen to some music. I will take this opportunity to clear my throat and get some water, and I'll be right back. Listen to the music. Jean Barta with the Custer's Luck Radio Show, and I am coming to you, like I said, from Alexandria, Virginia. And today is the January 3rd, and I'll be One, I wanted to do a show today because obviously I'll be going back to work in earnest this week and expect it may be difficult for me to do a show this week with a lot more going on than previously. Today I'm going to be reading from the preface and the first chapter of the book by Ralph Kirschner, which is The Class of 1861, Custer, Ames, and Their Classmates After West Point. Let me take a drink here and get started. The Class of 1861 is, in a way, a book of collective autobiography. Two classes graduated from the United States Military Academy at West Point in 1861 because of Lincoln's urgent need for lieutenants. This book covers all members of Adelbart Ames's May class and George Armstrong Custer's June class, including Southerners who left before graduation to join the Confederacy. And the author continues, I use Custer's fame to introduce the other 1861 graduates, some of whom, like Custer, became boy generals in the Civil War that was just beginning. For the most part, they tell the story in their own words. This book is their view of themselves. Naturally, it is very favorable. Others, of course, would have had a very different view of them, as many of these figures are controversial. But the Class of 1861 tries to maintain an autobiographical tone, with each sketch told from the subject's point of view. In part one, class members give not only accounts of battles, but analysis of the war. Much of the analysis is by Emory Upton, the class genius, and his friend, Henry A. DuPont, whose estate is now Winterthur Garden. Also heard from is mathematics professor and West Point librarian, Lieutenant Oliver Otis Howard, after whom Howard University is named. The chapters in part two, which I will relate to you later on this year, deal with these officers' lives after the war. Excerpts from a variety of writings make it possible to hear a subject's voice, as in Adelbart Ames's Journal While Abroad, written before he became governor of Mississippi. The first time a cadet is mentioned, his class, May or June, and class standing will be included in parentheses. I will also add, and this is written in the preface, that Appendix A of the book Roll Call gives brief biographical sketches of all the cadets and lists them in order of class standing. There is also the order of their photographs in the gallery, which includes non-graduates John Pelham and the other Southerners who became generals. Let me then continue on with the first chapter of the book, The Class of 1861, Introduction, Bugler's Assembly. George Armstrong Custer, number 34, June, was last in his class, or as he put it, only 34 graduated, and of these, 33 graduated above me. In his unfinished war memoirs, on which he was still working while riding to Little Bighorn, Custer says, the first official notification received by me of my appointment to the Military Academy bore the signatures of Jefferson Davis, then Secretary of War in the cabinet of President James Buchanan. Jefferson Davis, who graduated 23rd in West Point's class of 1828, actually served as Secretary of War from 1853 to 1857 in the administration of President Franklin Pierce. Davis extended the time cadets spent at the academy from 4 years to five, a change that remained until 1861, when Abraham Lincoln's need for lieutenants resulted in two classes graduating from the Military Academy in May and June of the same year, as well as a return to the four-year curriculum. The five-year course at West Point was one of Jefferson Davis's ideas that did not work out. Custer and Adelbart Ames, number five in May, exemplified different paths taken by Lincoln's lieutenants. Between the Civil War and his appointment as governor of Mississippi, Ames spent a year in Europe, where he wrote his journal while abroad, and met Napoleon III, William Cullen Bryant, Sir Edward Bulwer Lytton, and Hiram Powers, who gave Ames a tour of his studio in Florence. In London, Ames heard Charles Dickens read, noting in his diary on March 26, 1867, one of the two pieces was Pickwick's Trial, and more especially, Sergeant Buzz Foose's address to the jury. I remember a classmate speaking this same speech. The head of the class of May, Henry Algernon DuPont, won the Medal of Honor. After the war, he served in the family business E.I. DuPont, De Nemours and Company, and in the United States Senate from 1906 to 1917. In the 1920s at Winterthur, his home in Delaware, Henry A. DuPont wrote several books, including Rear Admiral Samuel Francis DuPont, a biography of his uncle. His son, Henry Francis, developed Winterthur Garden. As a cadet, Henry A. DuPont told his aunt on January 17, 1857, "I'm quite busy as usual, this monotonous life, with every minute, as it were, having something which must be done in it, makes the time pass very quickly, and before we know it, warm weather will be upon us, bringing a copious crop of dress parades, guard mountings, and drills." DuPont explained to his mother on October 3, 1858, why he was not a better student. "Not being very strong, the drills and riding make me so tired and sleepy at night that I am not able to study to much advantage." Yet, he was first in his class and lived until the last day of 1926. DuPont's father, also named Henry and also a graduate of West Point, learned in a letter dated October 29, 1859, "Colonel P. St. George Cook has been here for the last week experimenting on us in various movements of the new cavalry tactics which he is preparing." Although a Virginian, Philip St. George Cook would fight for the Union, unlike his famous son-in-law, Jeb Stuart, who would be killed by Custer's cavalry. Custer noted in his war memoirs from West Point to the battlefield that the cavalry was especially a young man's branch of service. "Of those who were cadets with me between the years 1857 and 1861, Custer recalls, "there were quite a number who became more or less distinguished during the war. He names Ames, Emory Upton, number 8 in May, and Judson Kilpatrick, graduating number 17 in May, of the class of May. Among these joining the Confederate forces who rose to distinction, according to Custer, were Wheeler, Rosser, Young, Robertson, and Kelly. It is somewhat remarkable that these five general officers held command in the cavalry. I might add my own name, thus showing that the cavalry offered the most promising field for early promotion." All except Wheeler graduated in 1861. Some of the training they received has been described by Henry A. DuPont in a letter to his mother. And he continues, "We have commenced riding and cutting heads without saddles and stirrups. I do not know whether you understand what is meant by cutting heads. It consists in cutting or thrusting with sabers at balls of leather stuffed with straws, and which are placed at various heights on posts, one or two being always placed on the ground so that you have to bend down to cut it as you gallop around in the hall. We often have quite lively times down there, especially when the bars are put up to jump, this being the signal for our numerous vicious and balky animals to display their accomplishments, refusing to go out when their turn comes, rearing, plunging, and kicking and throwing the ranks into the utmost confusion. However, next year when we are first classmen, we choose horses instead of having to take those which are left for us and, of course, have very good ones. The most influential soldier in the class of May is Emory Upton of upstate New York, the class genius who would write the military policy of the United States. George S. Patton's marked-up copy of Upton's book is in the USMA Library at West Point. Edmund Kirby, graduating number 10 in May, received a deathbed promotion from lieutenant to brigadier general from Abraham Lincoln. Judson Kilpatrick of New Jersey appeared in Herman Melville's poem, The March of the Sea. Kilpatrick is also mentioned in Gloria Vanderbilt's Black Knight, White Knight. He is her great-grandfather. Henry Walter Kingsbury, graduating number 4 in May, was killed by the troops of his brother-in-law, Confederate General David Rump Jones. One of the great cavalry generals mentioned by Custer was Tom Rosser, one of his best friends in the class of May. Thomas Lafayette Rosser, born in Virginia, and Thomas Lafayette Rosser, born in Virginia and appointed from Texas, was huge. He spent 6 months in the guardhouse for beating up an upperclassman who hates Rosser spent 6 months in the guardhouse for beating up an upperclassman who hazed him. He also spent time in Benny Havens' tavern drinking with Custer. Ex-cadet Edgar Allan Poe, class of 1834, reportedly called Benny Havens the only congenial soul in the entire God-forsaken place. Yet the second edition of Poems by Edgar Allan Poe is dedicated to the U.S. Corps of Cadets. John Pelham of Alabama was Rosser's roommate and probably the most popular man in the class. John Whitney Barlow, graduating number 14 in May, born in New York and appointed from Wisconsin, would explore Yellowstone and play a small part in creating a large national park. In his personal reminiscences of the war, Barlow described some of his classmates. There was Annibart Ames, a modest boy from Maine, who became a major general, a United States senator, and a governor of Mississippi. Kilpatrick of cavalry fame, Babcock, graduating number 3 in May, the favorite aide and private secretary of General Grant. Barlow adds, and upon the southern side was Rosser, who distinguished himself as a dashing cavalry leader, and since the war has met success and fortune on our northern railways. Let me take another break to clear my throat. I'll be right back. This is Jean Bartow with the Custer's Luck Radio Show, and it is January 3rd, 2015. And today I am reading from the first chapter, Bugler's Assembly, of the book, The Class of 1861, by Ralph Kirschner. And I can tell you that guests can call me at 646-787-8231 to listen. And they may also check out the show via the Blog Talk Radio website. I think the show link should be listed. I also had a chance to put it on Twitter very quickly before the show started. So if you go to hashtag Civil War or hashtag War or hashtag Blog Talk Radio, you will be able to find that link. Let me continue the brief vignettes about these young men graduating in May and June of 1861. John Adair, graduating number 13 in May, was born in Kentucky and appointed from Oregon. He was the only deserter in that class. He went to Canada. Justin Dimmick, number 26 in June, was a member of both the May and June classes. An example of why he did not graduate with his first set of classmates is given by one of the second, Joseph Farley, graduating number 21 in June, who describes a moral science class in West Point in the early 60s. Cadet Dimmick, Farley recalls, having encountered the recitation room with his section, proceeded to use his textbook as a football, shouting as he did so, quote, the virtues are what we are, and the duties are what we do. What we are is more important than what we do. Therefore, the virtues are more important than the duties. All this would result in smashing of a window pane at the moment when the instructor entered. And Farley adds, the order, quote, go to your orders and arrest Mr. Dimmick, was anticipated, which was the usual reproof for pranks of this kind. Patrick O'Rourke, graduating number one in June, an immigrant stonecutter from County Cavan, Ireland, was head of the class of June, of which Custer was the foot. Alonzo Cushing, number 12 in June, older brother of William Cushing, who blew up the Albemarle and received the thanks of Congress, appears in Stephen Vincent Benet's John Brown's body, where he, quote, held his guts in his hand. Alfred Mordecai, number 9 in June, was the son of the distinguished ordnance officer of the same name. Frank Reynolds, number 33 in June, who graduated behind everyone in the June class except Custer, joined the Khedive's army after the war and lived in a rundown palace in Alexandria, Egypt. Peter Conover Haynes, number 19 in June, who fired the signal gun at Bull Run and served as an engineer at the Siege of Vicksburg, was the only member of the class of 1861 to serve on active duty in World War I. John J. Garnett of the June class, after serving in the Confederate artillery, became an editor and publisher in New York, where he edited a biographical sketch of Ulysses S. Grant and published the official program of the opening of Grant's tomb. Grant says in his memoirs, there is a fine library connected with the academy. If people reveal themselves in their amusements, West Point's library circulation records and delinquency register can be useful. In the 1850s, the military academy, unencumbered by the privacy laws of the next century, kept a record of who checked out each book. And let me continue with that. On April 10th, 1858, Henri A. DuPont took out Motley's Dutch Republic. Tom Rosser, Prescott's Philip II. Custer, Cooper's novels. Emory Upton, Creasy's 15 Decisive Battles. And Adelbart Ames, Aristotle's Rhetoric. On the same day, John Lee checked out Knickerbocker, and John Kelly, Sims's Charlemont. 2 weeks later, on April 24th, 1858, Alonzo Cushing borrowed Harper's Magazine, Alfred Mordecai, Hazlitt's Life of Napoleon, and Justin Dimmick, Lady Lee's Widowhood. According to the Register of Cadet Delinquencies, John Whitney Barlow received 4 demerits for, quote, introducing strangers into the library, which took place July 27th, 1859. Orville Babcock got 5 demerits for, quote, visiting in division, not his own, and jumping out from window on April 3rd, 1857. The popular John Pelham got demerits for, quote, making unnecessary noise and tent on August 18th, 1856. Talking in the Fencing Academy, December 13th, 1856, and, quote, idle talking in Drawing Academy, April 14th, 1860. Adelbart Ames got demerits for spending too much time reading and drawing, quote, not returning book to library at proper time, October 7th, 1857, and, quote, leaving section and entering Drawing Academy without permission, January 13th, 1860. Custer got 5 demerits for being, quote, off cadet limits in rear of confectionery shop, August 11th, 1858. West Point's tranquility was broken by news of John Brown's raid in the United States Arsenal at Harper's Ferry. Brown was hanged. Brown was hanged on December 2nd, 1859. And the next day, Algernon DuPont wrote to his mother saying, there has been a good deal of talk here about John Brown, as everywhere else. A good many here seem to think the Union is going to be dissolved. Custer's family were Democrats, which was one reason he got along so well with Southerners and had a low opinion of abolitionists. Yet Custer later wrote, quote, it required more than ordinary moral and physical courage to boldly avow oneself an abolitionist. The name was considered one of opprobrium, and the cadet who had the courage to avow himself an abolitionist must be prepared to face the social frowns of the great majority of his comrades, and at times to defend his opinions by his physical strength and mettle. Emory Upton did so in a fight with Wade Hampton Gibbs of South Carolina. Morris Schaff of the class of 1862 reports, quote, when he was being quizzed on his arrival as a new cadet as to what he had studied and where he had been to school, he openly and frankly declared that he had been in Oberlin, been at Oberlin. Let me read that again. When Emory Upton was being quizzed on his arrival as a new cadet as to what he had studied and where he had been to school, he openly and frankly declared that he had been at Oberlin and was an abolitionist. Upton's secure declaration at once made him a marked man. Oberlin College, an anti-slavery stronghold in Ohio, admitted women and blacks. Gibbs made a remark about Upton at Oberlin and a fight that resulted on a December night in 1859 was perhaps the most famous at West Point. Morris Schaff says, it was the most thrilling event in my life as a cadet, and reports that, quote, I do remember that when the fight was over, I saw Upton's resolute face bleeding. Upton's intensity and seriousness may have been connected to his religious views, as he explained to Oliver Otis Howard, whose weekly prayer meeting he attended. I had heard but little profanity before I came here, Upton wrote in 1860 in a letter from West Point. And on my arrival, I was shocked. Upton said he felt best after the performance of any service or duty, which tends to draw off my mind from worldly things. And this is Jean Bartow with the Custer Suck Radio Show. I'm going to take another break and clear my throat and be back in about a minute. Please listen to this music. Thank you. everyone. This is Jean Bartow with the Custer's Luck Radio Show, and it is 5 o'clock on Sunday, January 3rd, 2015. And it is just about dusk here, and luckily I am close to getting done with my show, because otherwise I would be sitting in the dark. Guests can listen by going to the Blog Talk Radio website and finding my show link, and also going on Twitter to find it using hashtag Civil War, hashtag War, or hashtag West Point, which were three places that I recall where I posted Twitter feed earlier. Or they can call 646-787-8231. And I'll also add that the show will be archived once I'm finished here in another 20 minutes or so. Let me continue and finish my chapter, Introduction, Bugler's Assembly. And this part of the chapter is going to talk about the last months in late 1860 and early 1861. If John Brown's raid heightened sectional antagonism, the next year's presidential campaign brought it to the breaking point. Custer says, the Republicans, of course, espouse the cause championed by Lincoln and Hamlin, and the extreme Democrats announce themselves as under the banner of Breckinridge and Lane. A son of the latter was a member of my class and occupied an adjoining room. John Lane of the June class was the son of Joseph Lane, senator from Oregon, a running mate of John C. Breckinridge, the vice president of the United States, who would lose to Lincoln in 1860 and become a Confederate general. Senator Lane, who believed in the right of secession, was one of the few Northerners susceptible to the South. Although Senator Lane would not take part in the Civil War, his son John served in the Army of Northern Virginia, and another son, Lafayette, served in the Oregon State Legislature at the same time. There was another senator's son in the class of June, William Hamilton Harris, graduating number 8 in the June class. His father was Ira Harris of New York. His sister Clara would be a guest of the Lincolns in the presidential box at Ford's Theater on April 14, 1865. Some cadets, even at the beginning of 1860, saw that the war would follow the election returns, even if some of their leaders did not. Emory Upton told a sister on January 20, 1860, quote, "There will be no limit to the opportunities of doing good in the Army. There will be wounded soldiers to minister to and the dying to comfort." The next month, in an often, quote, inaccurate observation, Upton said, "Our profession differs from all others. It is a profession of fate, and a fatal profession. A long war would make many of us and prove the grave of as many." On March 4, 1860, a year before Lincoln took office, Henry A. DuPont wrote to his mother about, quote, "Queer beautiful weather today, so fine as to have a dress inspection on the plane for the first time since last fall. I enjoyed it exceedingly and have come to the conclusion that nothing can come up on a soldier's life, even a cadet soldier's." Of course, DuPont was not the only one to write about the beauty of the Hudson Valley. Charles Dickens said in 1842, "Any ground more beautiful can hardly be." Dickens was also struck by the casualty rate. But whether it be from the rigid nature of the discipline or the national impatience of restraint, or both causes combined, not more than half the number who begin their studies here ever remain to finish them. The national impatience would be seen during the 1860-1861 secession winter of discontent, and before that, during the presidential campaign, Custer recalls. The Breckinridge Army the Breckinridge Army of Southern Democrats did not hasten to announce, as their seniors in and out of Congress had done, that in the event of Lincoln's election, secession would be the only recourse left to the South. So high did political feeling run among the cadets, or a portion of one of them, says Custer, that Mr. Lincoln was hung in effigy one night to a limb of one of the shade trees growing in front of the cadet barracks. The effigy was removed early in the morning, so early that few of the cadets or professors ever knew of its occurrence. On November 6, 1860, Abraham Lincoln won 180 electoral votes to 123 for the other candidates and 39.8% of the popular vote in a four-way race. On December 21, 1860, Emory Upton told his sister, "Today's papers inform us that South Carolina has seceded. Let her go. She has been a pest, an eyesore, an abomination ever since she entered the Union. Were not that her example may become contagious, few would regret her course." Custer reports in his war memoirs that, quote, "Among the first of the cadets to leave West Point and hasten to enroll themselves under the banner of the seceding states were two of my classmates, Kelly and Ball of Alabama. Kelly became prominent in the war and was killed in battle. They took their departure from the academy on a Saturday. I remember the date the more readily as I was engaged in, to adopt the cadet term, walking an extra, which consisted in performing the tiresome duties of a sentinel during the unemployed hours of Saturday, hours usually given to recreation. On this occasion, I was pacing back and forth on my post, which for the time being ascended along the path leading from the cadet's chapel toward the academic building when I saw a party of from 15 to 20 cadets emerge from the open space between the mess hall and academic building and direct their steps toward the steamboat landing below. That which particularly attracted my attention was the bearing aloft upon the shoulders of their comrades of my two classmates, Ball and Kelly, as they were being carried in triumph from the doors of the academy to the steamboat landing. Too far off to exchange verbal adieus, even if military discipline had permitted it, they caught eye of me as step by step I reluctantly paid the penalty of offended regulations and raised their hats in token of farewell, to which, first casting my eyes and Custer continues, to which, first casting my eyes about to see that no watchful superior was in view, I responded by bringing my musket to a present. Let me take a brief drink of water here quickly. Pierce Manning Butler Young was another friend described by Custer. "I remember a conversation held at the table of which I sat during the winter of 60-61. I was seated as a cadet, PMB Young, a gallant young fellow from Georgia, a classmate of mine, and since the war, an intimate and valued friend. A major general in the Confederate forces during the war, and a member of Congress from his native state at a later date, the approaching war was, as usual, the subject of conversation in which all participated, and in the freest and most frequent manner. Finally, in a half jocular, half erect, half earnest manner, Young turned to me and delivered himself as follows, Custer, my boy, we're going to have war. It's no use talking. I see it coming. All the Crittenden compromises that can be patched up won't avert it. Now, let me prophesy what will happen to you and me. You will go home, and your abolition governor will probably make you a colonel of a cavalry regiment. I will go down to Georgia and ask Governor Brown to give me a cavalry regiment. And who knows but we may move against each other during the war. Custer adds, lightly as we both regarded this boyish prediction, it was destined to be fulfilled in a remarkable degree. And at this point, since my voice is giving out, that seems to be a good place to finish my show today with this often quoted vignette by George Armstrong Custer. Anyway, folks, I will be back hopefully later this week for a show, perhaps a brief 30 or 45 minute show during the week if I can swing it. Otherwise, next week during the weekend. Thanks so much for listening, and I apologize for my cough, and hopefully my voice will improve a little bit later this week. Enjoy your evening, and enjoy, I think this, from what I understand, this is perhaps the last regular football weekend of the 2015 season. So if you're looking, so if you're going to check out football, I hope everybody's favorite teams win. And it's my understanding that the Patriots either have played or will be playing tonight. I will check it out if they are playing now. Enjoy your evening, and I'll be back later in the week.